The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. I'm Faye Carruthers, standing in for Max as he suns himself at a charity golf jolly. On today's pod, we preview the Euro 2020 qualifiers, delve into public spats between ex-footballers, talk about Phil Neville's confidence, look ahead to the new Women's Super League season, we'll answer your questions and provide Barry with some dry shampoo. All that and more on today's Guardian Football Weekly. The panel today, Lars Sivertsen. I've missed you. It's been too long.
Well, you know, it's a squad game these days, Faye, so, you know, both of us have been out of rotation for a little bit. Where have you been on recently?
Yeah, I was on a couple of weeks ago.
It's only me then.
No.
But that's fine. You know, there's no I in pod.
I still listen to you all the time. Will Unwin, welcome back. Hello for the first time.
Hi.
First appearance this season.
Yeah, very much so. I don't think I got an appearance last season, so, you know, I'm very much the sort of Mangala of the pod team here.
Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
I don't want to know what you had for your breakfast. I just want to know if you washed your hair this morning. Quick yes or no?
No.
Or do?
I showered and my hair got wet and was rubbed. There was no shampoo involved.
It was rubbed. No shower gel.
Nope.
Either.
Just to put this in context, this hair-related chat stems from a friend of the show, Ellis James, stating on his BBC podcast that he washes his hair every single day, which I find extraordinarily weird, as did his co-host John Robbins and others. And I sort of did a mental tot and reckon I wash mine about four times a year.
I mean, I was
baffling.
I was just looking at all the tweets this
right
morning,
up
and
there
I was thinking,
with the Langdon no veg admission.
Where has this come from? And then looked into it, and just I can't even comprehend that. I mean, please don't take offence by this. I don't really want to think about you in the shower and what you do. It wasn't the opening thing I wanted to talk to you about, if I'm honest. However, this is baffling to me. Three times a year.
Well, yeah, I just don't see the need for it.
Cleanliness?
I wash three times a year,
yeah,
whether it's dirty
hair
or not. My hair is clean. Does it look dirty?
No, it doesn't. It looks very smart. Yeah. But anyway, I really wanted to get that out of the way.
Right, well, moving swiftly along.
Very, very swiftly along to Euro 2020 qualifiers. You know how much we all love an international week and we all sit there and message each other going, what are we going to talk about? Well, there's more to talk about than we thought. England playing Bulgaria at Wembley on Saturday, then going to Southampton to face Kosovo on Tuesday at St Mary's. Gareth Southgate's side, top of Group A, 2 wins from 2, 10 goals scored. So how straightforward is this going to be, Barry?
I think it's going to be very straightforward. England will qualify at their leisure. Still interesting to see how the new players who've been drafted into the squad get on, if they play. Unfortunately, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, who looked likely to play at some point, has had to pull out with a back injury. And unfortunately as well, Kosovo, who are quite an interesting team, will be without, I think, 4 of their best players, including their 2 absolute best pair of wingers, whose names I don't know, but I have read these players will be absent. And that's a bit of a shame, because I was looking forward to seeing them. But I think it will be very straightforward for England.
But also it's a shame, because surely Southgate's side need a bit more of a test in this, you know, qualifying situation to see, you know, how much they've progressed from the World Cup, perhaps. What do you think
Gareth
Southgate
needs to
do? I'm not
sure they'll get it against Bulgaria, to be honest.
That's what I mean.
No wins in 7, if I'm not mistaken, so it's not great form coming into it. But, I mean, with the fact that there are some absentees for England, I mean, that kind of makes it a little bit exciting, I guess, and you different guys in there. And you know, just like, being from a country whose team isn't that good and hasn't been very good for a long time, if I was supporting a national team that had like Raheem Sterling on one flank and Jadon Sancho on the other, I'd be quite excited about seeing that. I mean, that's a very good, that's good stuff.
Yeah, no? Jadon Sancho last week becoming the youngest player to score 15 Bundesliga goals, playing without any pressure. I mean, are you excited about seeing him, Will?
Yeah, you know, this England team at the moment is evolving, as Southgate says, and there's no better way to evolve than battering a few teams that aren't really up to their mark. You know, Bulgaria at the moment, They got a new coach in May. They've got five uncapped players in the squad, and four of those are over the age of 29, which is quite a feat. I don't know what your 37-year-old uncapped goalkeeper is going to bring to the squad at this stage. You know, 32-year-old striker that's never played for his country. They're just going to be whipping boys for England, and Southgate will be happy with that. He can play different teams over the two games coming up, and he can test everyone in it and make sure they take it seriously and add to the goals tally, and it will be quite good fun for everyone watching.
Disappointing that we won't get to see Wan-Bissaka, as you said, Barry, but especially bearing in mind all the fallout from, you know, the Kyle Walker thing and the reason everybody thought that Wan-Bissaka had been going into the team so that Southgate could get a look at him. We're now not going to get that opportunity. Who else for you should we be looking at?
I can see what you're doing here, Faye. You're trying to get me enthused about two matches, qualifying games that England are almost certainly going to win, pulling a cart. I just can't.
You do realise that this pod is normally an hour long, so yeah, you know, we're having to eke it out here.
Could you just not say something?
I think you should probably address that question to someone else.
Say something inflammatory about Declan Rice or something.
That's already been done, hasn't it? Gary Neville said that Declan Rice shouldn't be allowed to play because of his three Republic of Ireland caps, so that immediately then brings that back into the mix as well. Interesting comments as well from Les Reed earlier on this week, England's technical director, who claims that player arrogance was responsible for the under-21s' dismal showing at the European Championships as well. Obviously, some of those players tipped for a step up into the senior side.
Did Les name any names?
Not specifically.
Right. I could well believe it. There does seem to be a culture at clubs of young players who've got contracts but aren't featuring particularly often in the first team, of swanning around as if they've already cracked all this football malarkey and you know, giving it Billy Big Bollocks. But I don't know who he's specifically talking about or if what he says is correct, but it certainly wouldn't be the first young players to get notions above their station.
Mm.
And they did perform dismally at that tournament.
Yeah, they absolutely did. We cannot let this pod go without talking about this Michael Owen spat with Alan Shearer on Twitter comments.
I mean,
in his
it is
book.
Possible.
It is possible, but it wouldn't be quite as fun, would it? Also blamed Fabio Capello for finishing his England career as well. I mean, go on, who wants to go on this? Will, you look excited.
Yeah, you know, man wants to sell books and he's come up with a very cunning plan in a very public way. And, you know, he doesn't really care who he annoys because he's Michael Owen. And if it's Alan Shearer, if it's, you know, any other England striker you might have some slight beef with, it's, you know, all good goose of the gander and he's happy to make his money off the back of it. You know, it's pretty desperate stuff. You know, Michael Owen is generally, since he's retired, not really covered himself in glory, not a great co-commentator, not a good pundit. And, you know, all he seems to be able to do is spark the odd bit of controversy and fly fake helicopters around Dubai.
So, should Alan Shearer have got involved in that case?
Well, I think Alan Shearer has had a pop at Michael Owen in a book of his own previously. I mean, the Twitter spat is quite unedifying, but it's hilariously entertaining and, you know, everyone's gripped to it for a day or whatever. It created quite a lot of talking points. As Will says, obviously Michael Owen wants to sell books. He seems to be incredibly unpopular with fans of almost every club he's ever played for, which, considering how good he was, is quite remarkable. He said that going from Real Madrid to Newcastle was a step down. He saw it as a step down, didn't want to go. And it is a step down. You know, going from Real Madrid to most clubs is a step down. But taking on Alan Shearer, I think, is a battle he's not going to win, because Alan Shearer is a Newcastle legend and Michael Owen is loathed on Tyneside, with reasonably good reason. Because he took a lot of money out of the club and delivered practically nothing in return.
And an England legend as well, as is Michael Owen. He's kind of in danger of damaging his own legacy, really, isn't he?
I think that ship has sailed already, to be honest. He seems... I don't know if Michael Owen is even that interested in football. His passion is for horse racing. Mm. He has made that abundantly clear. He seems... I mean, when he went into the stud and bloodstock business, he was quite good at it. He had a horse called Brown Panther, which won a race at Royal Ascot, but unfortunately died a few years afterwards. So I'm not sure that how that affected his business. I don't know if his business is as successful as it could have been because of the death of that horse. But I also don't know how desperately Michael Owen is in need of cash, because he does do a lot of very cheesy adverts for money. I've heard him on a radio station doing a have you been in an accident that wasn't your fault ad for some law firm. You're going, crikey, that is a barrel bottom being scraped there.
That's my kind of voiceover level.
Have you accidentally twanged your knee?
I suffered a lot of injuries when I was a player. Have you had an injury that wasn't your fault?
Clang.
And you're kind of going, crikey, Michael, are you just greedy or are you broke? I don't know.
Maybe he likes it. Maybe that's like the... He's in it for the art. Yeah. No, but I think it's generally not a bad thing that ex-players feel that they're free to speak their mind and say exactly what they think when they do these books. But then again, fans are equally free to think they're massive bellends on the back of what they say and what turns out to be in their minds. And I suspect that is what's happened here.
Wales, Azerbaijan, Group E. Wales fourth, Azerbaijan bottom, 0 points. I've seen some suggestions, though, that anything but a win against Azerbaijan, which you would expect, could see Ryan Giggs in trouble.
I think Ryan Giggs is already in trouble, to be honest. And if they don't win this game, I would imagine, you know, they will not qualify. They have no hope. He hasn't done well as Wales manager, considering the players he has at his disposal. You could argue he's done very badly. And if they win this game and, say, Slovakia and Croatia, who are playing on Friday as well, draw, that would put Wales in a much healthier position. But I think anything less than a win at home to Azerbaijan would be curtains for Ryan Giggs. But there does seem to be a bit of a feeling that he's not doing very well. Well, the results speak for themselves.
Mm. Losing away to Croatia happens. Losing away to Hungary is not great, but not a complete catastrophe. I mean, they've had a fixture-wise a tricky start to this group, so there's still time, but obviously Azerbaijan at home is... You really need to get something there. And I guess the good news is that Gareth Bale looks like he's rediscovered football. Whether he likes it or not, I don't know, but he's playing quite well, actually, now, in spite of everything at Real Madrid, which surely is important for Wales.
Yeah, you know, as I said, Bale's in form, finally, after a long summer for him, and they've got lots of other players that are in form. You know, even you look at Johnny Williams, who is back and doing great things at Charlton after a fine finish to last season. He's carried it on now, and they're second in the league after promotion. On top of that, Harry Wilson's now playing in the Premier League and showing what he can do. You know, arguably, it's a better squad than what Chris Coleman had at his disposal at times. You know, Swansea centre back Joe Roden's doing great, and he sets the start. Neil Taylor's had more Premier League minutes than any Welsh player, so he might even keep out Ben Davies, who's, you know, seen as, you know, a sort of key component of the side for many a year. And so things are looking positive. You know, in midfield, Joe Allen's still doing well, and, you know, Matt Smith's now playing at QPR. He's not covered himself in glory yet so far, but, you know, things are getting better and progressing, and they really should absolutely hammer Azerbaijan, who are 130-odd in the world.
So what is the problem then?
I don't follow the Welsh thing as closely as Barry does, of course. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I will... You are slightly hostage to the fixture list with these things, no? So you've had... You've already had, like, I mean, Croatia and Hungary away are probably your two hardest games in this group. And so you've had them and you've lost them. That's fair enough. But in your next two games now, this international, well, that's a friendly. And you've got you're playing Azerbaijan, and after which you've got stuff like playing Slovakia, which I guess you can claw back some of this, even though it's not looking brilliantly, I guess.
Yeah, you can, but I think you're underestimating the quality of the Welsh squad. You know, they'll have a front three tomorrow, one would imagine, of Dan James, Harry Wilson and Gareth Bale. That's a serious trident to have up front. Aaron Ramsey has withdrawn from the squad, but, you know, in normal circumstances, he would be there. Again, a world class player. So I think it's the manner of their defeats in those away games that has been caused concern. There's no shame in losing them, but they perhaps should at least be drawing them.
Yeah, sir.
Scotland are playing Belgium. Both Hazard brothers are out, Edin and Torgan. So does that change anything for Scotland, Barry?
It does, obviously. The absence of Eden Hazard is a huge boost for them. They have to play Russia first on Friday. Belgium is on Monday. And Scotland also have the safety net of a guaranteed playoff place on the back of their Nations League. Heroics such as they were, and I've thought that might be detrimental to their qualifying campaign, in that they're going to go, we have this thing to fall back on. And I think that was kind of apparent in their game against Kazakhstan, where they got absolutely mullered. That was Alex McLeish's, I think, last game in charge. Steve Clarke has come in now. He's masterminded victory in Cyprus. They lost against Belgium. And the Scottish players have been praising his amazing attention to detail, which I always think is, you know, it sounds as if they're having a dig at his predecessor when they say that. So the talking point, obviously, in the Scotland camp this week has been about Ollie McBurney. I don't know if you heard what happened.
No.
Either before or after a Sheffield United game, he was talking to John Fleck, his teammate and his international teammate, and he basically suggested that he wasn't that keen on going away on Scotland duty because, to quote, it's shit.
This is a problem that they've had for a while, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, I think it could be argued he could have put forward the banter defence and it was just a joke. But anyway, he was basically summoned by Steve Clarke and apparently has apologised to his teammates. It could be a storm in a teacup, but it's the kind of thing that if they lose, it's not going to be helpful. Or if he plays badly, it's not going to be helpful. But if he scores a goal or two, it'll all soon be forgotten. But these are two very important fixtures for Scotland, and you know, their entire chances of qualification hinge on them. You'd think Russia and Belgium on Friday, Monday, and you'd think they'd need at least a win out of that, if not more. They do need more than a win.
So that
maybe it is a bit shit, and they need to just do more things to make it fun.
That's what, like, I was just going to say. What is the problem?
Have a pub quiz, or play some Mario Kart in the hotel, or do like the inflatable animals thing.
Training camps with Lars.
The Danish squad, when they won the Euros, I mean, back in the day, they played mini golf quite a bit, I believe. So maybe get the mini golf on.
And they also didn't have a boring training camp because they all got hauled off back from their holidays.
Maybe
with
that's
about
what
a day's notice.
Yeah.
I mean, I get
to just send the Scotland squad to Magaluf for a bit and see what happens.
Oh, maybe not.
I get that players, particularly fringe players on teams, international teams, might not be that enthusiastic about travelling, because if you're not guaranteed a game, or if you know you're not going to be playing, it must be quite tedious and soul-destroying, even though, you know, there are fans who go, I would do anything to play for my country. But the reality, when you're there and not being picked, I can totally understand why you might think it's an ordeal and a grind. You know, I'd still go, but
I was going to say it's a squad game. Every, you know, the coaches are always at great pains to say that every player is important and every player has a role to play at a training camp. And yeah, an ego might say,
well, that's very much all animals are equal, but some animals are far more equal than others, isn't it?
But you're only ever an injury away from getting your opportunity. So why would you not put in 100% effort?
But this is a very positive spin. You've not been to Kazakhstan away and watched your team lost 3-0 from the bench and wondering how can it be worse than this lot. So.
Listen, I spin everything positively, and you know, these players aren't in a bad position, I would suggest.
But for fans, it's a dream to represent your country. For many players, it is too, but also for players, it's a job, and some of them aren't that enthused about it. I can, if I had was blessed with the physical coordination to be good enough to play for Ireland, I would not be one of those players who tried to miss out, you know, or made up injuries to get out of international duties. But I can kind of understand why.
I just think that's unprofessional.
Just make it more fun. Maybe, I mean, make sure for the next squad, Ollie McBurney will be excited about playing shuffleboard with Scott McTominay or something.
Isn't McBurney actually from Yorkshire? Maybe it's just doesn't have that strong allegiance, yeah, despite his name. Just doesn't get as excited.
I mean, his comments may have been blown hugely out of proportion, you know, you say it's an unprofessional thing, and it is unprofessional, but lots of people are unprofessional and lazy.
Very true. Very true. Republic of Ireland hosts Switzerland tonight. They've got a friendly against Bulgaria on Tuesday as well. Currently top of Group D, 10 points, perhaps a slightly inflated position. I don't know if you've seen these comments from Roy Keane. He's been talking about Jonathan Walters. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
Let me guess, he thinks they're all rubbish.
Okay, I'll read the quotes for you. He talks a good game. Imagine if he'd won a trophy. He goes on the TV about how he was harshly treated by me. He's crying on the TV about his family situation. Maybe he should lie low for a while. Have a look at his medals. That wouldn't take long.
Yeah, Roy was appearing at some sort of live show with Gary Neville last night, sponsored by a chocolate bar, and the reference to Jonathan Walters was Jonathan Walters appeared on an Irish chat show, I think last year, called The Late Late Show, and got very emotional when he was talking about the death of his mother and then the death of his brother. I think in the space of 3 or 4 days he lost his brother, his wife had a miscarriage, and his daughter was diagnosed with scoliosis, which is some sort of back condition, I think, or spinal condition. So yeah, it was quite the trifecta of bad news, and he got quite emotional and upset while talking about it.
And what's wrong with that? Which is why I get annoyed with Roy Keane coming up with something like that. What's his family situation and him talking about it got to do with anything?
Yeah, I think that was below the belt from Roy. The medals thing. You know, Roy also, in the course of this evening, he was wallowing in self-pity of his own, saying that he thought himself and Martin O'Neill had been very hard done by, and he claims they were a success when they were in charge of Ireland because they qualified for one tournament and got to the playoff before another. Now, that's, for me, at odds with Roy's previous comments saying that, you know, Ireland should be doing more than just qualifying. We should be going to tournaments trying to win them, and not there just making up the numbers. So, you know, Roy changes his mind like the weather, and he possibly didn't know that his comments before this live audience, off-the-cuff comments, would end up making headlines. But
really? He's been
Roy
around
Keane.
For long enough, hasn't he, yeah, to know?
Or he just doesn't care. But
no.
He also says he sees his own future in management. Apart from one good season with Sunderland, his entire managerial career has been an abject failure. He doesn't seem to be able to get a tune out of players. And
it's almost hard to understand that.
and the manner,
general appearance, yeah,
with the comments he's made about Jonathan Walters would explain that he perhaps doesn't have the empathy required to be a successful manager.
His management skills, yeah, are perhaps lacking.
A lot of stick and very little carrot.
I mean,
by
when
the sound
they do eventually discover time travel, he could go back to the 60s and perhaps be an effective coach in that sort of environment, I think. Maybe that could be something for him. I don't know. No, not today, though, I don't think.
The problem with Keane now is that, you know, he's a long-time retired as a player and he's talking about medals when actually, if you look at his career since he's retired, it's been, you know, as Barry says, pretty dreadful as a manager. And I think he's not really accepted that yet. As you say, he wants to go back into management, but it's very unlikely that anyone's going to give him a chance because he'll be dreadful again.
Mm, right, we'll go back to the football. Switzerland tonight, Republic of Ireland, top of Group D. Is this an inflated position? How much of a tough opponent is Switzerland going to be later?
I don't think it's an inflated position. They've beaten Gibraltar home in a way. They've beaten Georgia at home, so they couldn't do any more from those three fixtures. And they've got a point against Denmark away.
Which is good.
So they are in a good position,
yeah,
but they need to consolidate that position.
But I would say, though, I mean, the other teams haven't played Gibraltar twice. So in terms of where you are, it's a pretty...
Yeah, but short of beating Denmark away, we couldn't be any better.
No, that's fair. That is absolutely fair. I'm just not entirely convinced. I mean, when there's such a discrepancy in quality between teams within the group, when you play Gibraltar, we'll have a lot to say for where you end, how the table looks. I'm not. You're right. You can only beat what's put in front of you, but I don't think that necessarily means they're in the right place. They've only conceded one. So
I don't understand this. They couldn't be in a better place.
No, that's for sure. I'm just saying I wouldn't break out the bunting because they're top of the league. Like, yay, we're top of the qualifying league. This is going really well.
Well, it's better than not being top of the qualifying league.
That's true. And if they hadn't beaten Gibraltar, that would have been very bad. Yeah. And you would have had to like set fire to the bunting or something.
Georgia at home is very much... the kind of match you could well expect or imagine Ireland messing up.
Well, then it would have been going very, very bad.
I would have expected them to lose against Denmark and Copenhagen. So, you know, I'm taking the positives.
That's fair.
But yeah, a lot done, more to do.
Northern Ireland have beaten Belarus and Estonia both home and away. Just the four games to come against Germany and the Netherlands. They host Luxembourg for a friendly tonight before Germany arrive in town on Monday. Not much of a warm-up fixture, is it?
No, but that situation is quite exciting, and we're going to go on to that if we talk about Germany versus Netherlands later, because that's obviously also a case of the fixture list putting them in a slightly false position in inverted commas. But what they've done is that they've gotten the job done against the lesser teams, which means, especially since the Dutch lost against Germany, if they can get anything from any of the games against Germany, which is unlikely, I know, or anything from any of the games against Holland... suddenly it looks very interesting, that group.
This is... I'm beginning to think there's some sort of anti-Irish sentiment here, because they're in exactly the same position as the Republic of Ireland.
But I just said...
But their position is great and ours is terrible. No,
that's not at all what I said, Barry.
It kind of is.
No.
This is the most controversial Northern Ireland Republic of Ireland situation at the moment.
And do you know what? Funnily enough, somebody on Twitter, I saw a question earlier on, what's the biggest ego spat that's happened on the pod behind the scenes? Here we go. We're starting one. Germany play the Netherlands on Friday, both expecting to get out of Group C, obviously, but their previous meeting ended 3-2 to Germany. Another defeat for the Netherlands. They could be getting nervous, Will.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you say, it's not been plain sailing. You know, they played Germany a lot in recent years. Well, in the last year, it's four times now. You know, they've come into it with Germany missing some strikers. They've had to call up a woman who hasn't got a cap, so it's probably a good time to play them. But they have to get the job done. And you know, Koeman's a smart man. You know, he's got Depay in reasonable form. He's got Ryan Barbel in existence, which is always positive. The problem they've got is De Ligt's been not playing at Juventus, and then when he has, he was pretty awful against Napoli at the weekend. So it's going to be an interesting tussle between the two teams who know each other very well, and I'd probably suspect that Germany will come out on top in the end.
I mean, nobody gave Northern Ireland a prayer when this draw was made, but if Germany beat the Netherlands on Friday, that puts them in a brilliant position, and... with the Netherlands already assured of their playoff place, they may not be that fussed about qualifying through the usual channels.
What chance do you give them, Lars?
Northern Ireland. I think they do have a chance, like I said, because they've gotten the easy games out of the way in the inverted commas, and they've done a good job there. And it's all about Germany or the Netherlands. Netherlands ideally messing up. I think this is a really interesting game, to be honest, because Germany have got some exciting... I think they've got some exciting players going forward. We'll probably see Royce and Gnabry either side of Timo Werner. Werner scored five games in his first three games for RB Leipzig this season. But at the back, like, you're looking at a defensive partnership of maybe Süle and Jonathan Tah. It's not... like, they're pretty composed on the ball, but defensively not amazing. So if Memphis Depay has a good day, it should be possible for them to hurt them. So it should be interesting.
Just going back to Group D briefly, in the Republic of Ireland's group, Denmark go to Gibraltar, but domestically, the big news there is that Nicholas Bentner's signed with FC Copenhagen. Has anyone seen this training montage video?
Yeah, I got hit in the head by one of the shots, I think, when I was wandering around London.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I wonder, it wouldn't be Okay, so Nicholas Bentner obviously hasn't fully worked out for Rosenborg the way they'd hoped. I mean, they'd spent more money on him than a team from that size of league should really spend on someone like Nicholas Bentner. He was completely fine for the first two seasons. Maybe not quite as good as they were hoping, but all right. And then this year, they've got a new coach in who just decides that he doesn't run enough. He wants a centre forward who can run, and he's been completely ostracised from the squad. There's also been, it's been reported that other players felt he was being given preferential treatment and stuff. So they just kind of decided that ostracising him from the squad was the thing to do. And he's been making videos on Instagram and this sort of thing. And you can, when FC Copenhagen pick him up, your first instinct is to think, who in the world looks at Nicholas Bentner in 2019 and thinks this is a route we want to go down? But in fairness to Bentner, it wasn't his, I mean, he didn't, it was the club who ostracised him. And he'd never badmouthed the club or anything. He didn't say anything. He was always very positive about his time at Rosenborg. And it just didn't work out in the end. And I guess if he comes on a free, I don't know what the contractual wages situation is. Okay, he's probably not costing them that much. So it might be a punt worth taking. I don't know.
TV2 tweeted out this video.
Yes, I mean,
and the thing is, you don't know how many shots he's taken, but it's basically a training ground montage of the most pathetic shot. I mean, I was on Soccer AM last week and did a pretty abysmal volley at the end of the show. I could have done better than Nicholas Bentner did in that training montage. There were so many poor shots. As I say, don't know how long he was there for.
Well, the most recent video of Bentner I saw, he'd certainly scored. It was him and a young lady cavorting around an apartment in not wearing many clothes.
Not seen that one. Probably looking at different sites to you, Harry, I suggest.
Oh, someone sent it to me on WhatsApp.
They all say.
Yeah, okay.
Feeling that we're about to move on from international things, can I just flag up? I think Alfinger Haaland's kid, Erling Haaland, could get his debut for Norway this week. He's a player to look out for. He's an absolute mountain of a man. He's only 19, but he can still get around the pitch a little bit. I think you'll see him in England at some point. He's playing for RB Salzburg in Austria at the moment, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he's scored 8 goals in his last 5 for the club, so on decent form for his club. I think he'll probably feature for Norway at some point.
We just need Roy Keane to have a son who comes up against him.
You wouldn't want to. This fella's big.
That's it for part one. We've already heard some interesting comments from a variety of big names in football. Part two, we'll be hearing the thoughts of Phil Neville. Welcome to part two. Now, Phil Neville's been covering himself in glory again this week, nominated for the best FIFA women's coach, which surprised a lot of people. He's been defending himself against the criticism which came with that. His quote was, "People would have absolutely criticised me, but I was brave enough to make those decisions because I trusted the players and they trusted me, and I'll continue to do that. I have a vision that nobody else has. I've got bravery that no other coach has probably had. So, do you know what? Thank your lucky stars I'm here. I'm here to stay. And I'm going to continue to keep improving. I've got a long way to go, but I think with the set of players we've got and with my philosophy, I think we can go a long way. I live and breathe it, and I never have a bad day." And I'm just going to qualify, this next question has come from producer Jonathan and not from my lips. Is there more a David Brent manager in the game today?
I don't think so. I mean, the Second Captains podcast boys have already, during the World Cup, I think they dreamt up this soundbed, which had David Brent and quotes from David Brent and quotes from Phil Neville sort of challenging people to tell which was which, and it was quite difficult. He has a very high opinion of himself, that there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm not convinced he's a particularly good manager, and I don't think he covered himself in glory at the World Cup. But yeah, he's not short of self-confidence, and that's heartwarming to see.
But I was going to say, that is there actually anything wrong with having a bit of self-confidence? We've got this very English attitude where we play everything down, and the minute somebody starts being a little bit bolshy about their achievements or not, in this case at the moment, with regard to England anyway, then they start to batter them down a little bit.
He's certainly not a chilled-out entertainer, that's for sure, though. I don't think Neville does have a massive amount to back it up with. You know, those World Cup games, they should have won. You know, I think they should have done better against the USA in the semi. He keeps seeing very strange things. Lucy Bronze, obviously the best right back in the world, and he was playing in midfield again this week. And I think you really need to get something on the board other than the She Believes Cup to, you know, put down your marker as a coach. You know, he's been saying that he's the best around. He's probably linked himself with the USA job. And he's just not actually got anything in his background. You know, his time in coaching with men's football, it was pretty mediocre at United, pretty mediocre in Valencia, and, you know, in summary, mediocre. You know, you've got to have a certain level of self-confidence in football. There's no arguing about that. But I guess it's also a case of how you manage that yourself, especially in the public eye as he is. And I don't really think he gives the best impression of himself, which there might be a reason behind that, because he believes what he says. But, you know, there's still a certain, you know, expectation management about your own person. And he's probably going a bit above and beyond it at the moment.
He also seems to... Well, I'm not sure in this instant, but he has a habit of saying what I think he thinks people want to hear.
I agree.
And ends up contradicting himself quite a lot, which, you know, it's almost as I will say this thing now and hopefully no one will remember this other thing I said 3 days ago that was the exact opposite. Say a case in point being, winning third place playoff would be, that's for losers, we're not interested in that, and then going on to, you know, we're well up for this.
It was the opposite. He did it the opposite way around. He said, you know, we want a bronze medal. Then after the game, when they lost it, said it's a nonsense game, which, you know, and the criticism levelled at him about that is fair. I think we'll all agree the third place playoff is not necessarily the best thing in football. However, tell that to any player who has a bronze medal around their neck from any World Cup in the past. So I spent a lot of time with him in France and interviewed him a lot, and he's got a lot of really good qualities. But I would agree with you in terms of, I think sometimes he slips himself up by getting carried away in a lot of rhetoric and excitement. He doesn't think before he speaks, and that's where you then get a lot of the contradicting, because he's forgotten what he's said before, because he is, as you said, I think, just trying to say what he thinks a manager should be saying. And I'm all for the positivity and things like that, but I just think sometimes he needs to start backing it up on the pitch.
Yeah, I do think when I first saw those statements this week, you read that and you think, you know, if you'd just shown him that on a piece of paper or read it back to him and asked him, is this a very clever thing to tell the press right now? I think he would concur that no, it would not be a clever thing to say. Now, there's nothing wrong with backing yourself, but, you know, that was something else. Like, it was half an R. Kelly song the way it was going on, like, and it's not where you want to be.
I think he just gets a bit carried away sometimes, and I think the sentiment is there. He's trying to do the best thing. I do genuinely think he really enjoys managing the women's team, and they've got this 2-year vision, you know, for the Olympics coming up in 2020 in Tokyo, and then a home Euros in 2021. But something is not clicking on the pitch. And Jodie Taylor came out and made some comments that England are playing the best football they've played in years. And I think there's quite a lot of people that would disagree with that.
Right. Well, I don't know. Because I didn't really take much of an interest before this World Cup, to be honest. But you would know better than me, Faye. Do you?
I would say they're playing nice football sometimes, but they're very, very sloppy.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating.
I'd agree with that. I wasn't hugely impressed with what I saw during the World Cup. I thought they could have done a hell of a lot better. Well, and I would hold him responsible, because I think some of his tactics were just bizarre.
Yeah, well, that 3-0 win over Norway was arguably their best performance. So you could argue, I know it's a friendly, that they've gone slightly backwards. I know they didn't have Jill Scott. There's a number of players, Ellen White's injured at the moment as well. But, you know, a 2-1 defeat to Norway, having battered them you know, 3-0 in the quarterfinals of the World Cup is a backward step. And the goal they got was a stunner from Georgia Stanway, which she's more than capable of. But then they conceded from a set piece, and then Millie Bright gave the ball away for the winner for Norway. So, you know, they're the kind of things defensively they're looking really weak, I think.
I would say if he's coming out with the sort of stuff in team talks and at training sessions that he comes out with at press conferences, I'd say it won't be very long before his players get really sick of him. You can just imagine the eye rolling and, you know, sniggering that goes on if he's coming out with that sort of waffle, you know, behind closed doors.
Well, it's difficult because I remember his opening press conference at the World Cup, and he said, if we don't win this, we'll come home with egg on our face. And my immediate reaction to that is, why would you say that? You've literally just written all the headlines. If you don't, you're putting an enormous amount of pressure on your players. There's nothing wrong with saying you want to go out and win it, but are you going to be coming back with egg on your face if you don't? Not really.
I don't think he understands that everything he says will actually be printed in the media or put on TV. It's very, as you've said before, it's a very strange concept that he comes up with what he says, and he doesn't think before he says it and forgets everything he said in the past. And I think he probably came in thinking winning the Women's World Cup would be a lot easier than it was. You know, and look at recently, as you say about the defence, like conceding 3 goals against Belgium, who are a long way from world beaters, and mm-hmm. needing a late penalty from Nikita Paris to get out of that with any sort of result is, you know, it's pretty poor. And, you know, he's using this time to tinker, but he seems to have so many ideas that he doesn't actually seem to have a settled plan that he's looking for, you know, for the next 2 years down the line in this plan that he's got. You know, it's every game it seems something a little bit different. And as I said before about Lucy Bronze playing midfield when she doesn't seem to particularly enjoy it. And, you know, with her and Nikita Paris down the right is England's biggest threat. Every time I've watched England women's, and, you know, can't say I'm a regular, but they always seem like they could, you know, the best combination in world football down that right wing.
Mm.
And not utilising that just seems bizarre.
I can understand the tinkering. You know, basically it's friendlies now. Leading into the Olympics and then, of course, leading into the Euros because they qualify as the home nation naturally, so they don't have to go through the qualifiers. They've got Brazil coming up on the 5th of October, which will be a completely different challenge. But as Will said, there just doesn't seem to be an identity there. There's only so much tinkering you can do before you lose all kind of identity, and then you're not actually regularly training in the way you want to play.
I should add as a caveat, I quite like Phil Neville, and he strikes me as
absolutely
a really nice bloke.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel a bit bad slagging him off. But what strikes me is someone who changes their mind and tinkers as much as he does and forgets what he said in the past and says something completely different. It strikes me as someone, and people are welcome, I've probably contradicted myself on the pod on numerous occasions over 10 years, but it strikes me as someone who doesn't really have strong convictions, and that's possibly why he keeps flip-flopping on various things. And it seems to show in his team selection, you know, squad rotation and tinkering, but he says he trusts all his players, so that's fair enough. The standout thing he said, I think it was his very first press conference when he got the job, was he said, I know people want me to fail. And that's always stuck with me because it simply wasn't true.
Mm.
And I don't know where he got it from. So if there's still this siege mentality there,
almost a bit of an inferiority complex or a kind of needing to needing to prove people wrong, which he doesn't have to.
Well, I think he does now, but he didn't then.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think people really wanted him to succeed,
and that's the thing.
People, by and large, like Phil Neville.
Yeah, because he's a humble, down to earth, you know, likable guy.
And during the Bury thing, you know, because his mum was still involved with Bury, his father was very heavily involved with Bury before he died. He spoke brilliantly about the subject, and you know, he just seems like a good guy, but. Whereas I don't think he had to prove himself when he got the job. People didn't want him to fail. People wanted him to succeed. I think now he possibly does have to do better.
WSL this weekend kicks off. Manchester Derby at the Etihad and Stamford Bridge for Chelsea against Tottenham. Now, opening fixtures at men's clubs grounds. What do we think of that?
I can see why it could be a good idea. I don't know what kind of crowds they're going to draw. Hopefully there'll be big ones. But I think I would rather play in a full small stadium than a not very full big one, personally, if I was a footballer. But yeah, again, I would have to defer to your superior knowledge.
Well, I think Stamford Bridge is if it's not a sellout, it's close to.
Oh, well, that's
about
fantastic.
40,000. But Chelsea have come out and admitted, you know, that they've given away a lot of free tickets, you know, cheap tickets for kids, obviously.
Well, that's all right.
Well, absolutely, because you've got to grow the game. And the biggest criticism of what happened after the success of the 2015 World Cup, then going into the WSL season, was that after the initial interest, then you didn't keep the attendances, and there was like a 78% surge initially, and then it dropped right off again. So that's their biggest challenge. And you will get some fans potentially taking kids just because they want to go to Stamford Bridge, and that's an affordable way to take them to Stamford Bridge. But, you know, that's how you get fans. They've also talked about using the data. Obviously, when people sign up for tickets, they can then, you know, use that to sell future fixtures to them. So there's a commercial aspect to it to try and grow it.
Yeah, and I think at the Etihad, you know, I'm from 2 miles down the road from the Etihad, and, you know, it's a working class area. You know, City nowadays, it's not the most affordable place to go, regardless of what their PR says. And it's a great opportunity to get fans in that, as you say, not always going to be able to go to the Etihad. It should be affordable, far more affordable than Premier League football. And, you know, giving away tickets at Stamford Bridge is a good idea. And just to show the potential of what it's like when it's full, what it's, you know, what atmosphere can be created, what the quality of football is available. You know, I would say the one downfall is that it's, you know, coming up to mid-September now, and the Women's World Cup finished a long time ago, and so they've lost a little bit of momentum because the Premier League has taken that, and which is unfortunate. And I think was it Jade Moore said that it's, you know, that momentum has gone a bit, and it's a bit upsetting that WSL haven't been able to utilise it as they could have. But, you know, Manchester Derby, regardless of who's playing, whether it's the under-21s, under-8s or the first team, it's going to be, you know, a very exciting prospect. You know, it's United in the top flight, City have had a bit of a revamp over the summer. So it's going to be interesting, and it's going to be new for everyone, you know, new for a lot of people that are going to go to it, and should be a great occasion at the Etihad, which is the stadium I know more, and say a sellout at Stamford Bridge would be another fine occasion.
It does normally start a little bit earlier. Kelly Simmons was asked this on the day of the launch, actually, and FIFA give a window of when you have to have some international friendlies and a break, and the window was then. And so when they were looking at the best marketing ploy for the league, the first men's international weekend is now. There's not, you know, it's a little bit, they've got an equivalent of non-league day coming up as well in a couple of months' time to try and generate more interest when people aren't at Premier League games and Championship games, which I think is why it's starting a bit later. But I absolutely agree with that point that, you know, the momentum has slipped a bit, and then you see the two slightly abject performances from England in those two friendlies as well. That doesn't really help. But still, you know, they made enough of a new crop of fans to attract new people there.
Do you think they've marketed well, though? I didn't know it was starting this weekend until you said so about 5 minutes ago.
Well, yeah, I thought they had, but clearly, I mean, perhaps that's because my Twitter algorithms are more suited, because, yeah, you know, I follow women's football, so I get more of the stuff. But that they've launched FA Player, which is going to be a massive game changer, which means you can watch the games online, and the content is now all in one place, that they've ramped that up. I thought there had been quite a lot more advertising than previously before, but that's interesting from your point of view that you've not noticed that.
No, completely oblivious to it.
Okay, fair enough. Well, it is starting this weekend.
I'll take your word for it.
So you can pay attention and tell us your thoughts on Monday. That's it for part two. In part three, we're going to be discussing the fallout from the Romelu Lukaku racism incident. Welcome to part three. We'll start by discussing the fallout from the Romelu Lukaku racism incident at Cagliari. Nicky Bandini joins us on the line. Just to give some context of this, if people haven't seen it, Inter Milan ultras have basically written this open letter telling Romelu Lukaku that the monkey chants aimed at him were not racist, but were actually, according to them, a way of distracting opponents. And they're claiming that he should take it as a form of respect. I'll just give you some highlights from this letter. "We're really sorry you thought that what happened in Cagliari was racist. You have to understand that Italy's not like many other North European countries where racism is a real problem. We understand it could have seemed racist to you, but it's not like that. In Italy, we use some ways only to help our teams and to try and make our opponents nervous, not for racism, but to mess them up. We're not racist, and neither are the Cagliari fans." As I said, Nicky Bandini on the line for us. I mean, that's quite an astounding open letter, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is astounding. It's certainly shocking that they would put it in a letter. I mean, the thing which I sort of have to communicate a bit, which you know, is not an encouraging thing to have to communicate, but the rhetoric here, this idea that it's not really racism, it's not really could be something else, could be homophobia, could be anti-Semitism, it's just a thing that we do to distract our opponents, that's really not new to anyone who's sort of spent time around ultra culture in Italy. You know, that idea is really prevalent. I remember spending a bit of time with some Lazio ultras for a piece before a Rome derby a few years ago, and I challenged them on that and said, "What is the, you know, if all of this is okay, then what isn't okay? What, when, is there a line?" And the answer I got at the time was death. But actually, if you go through you know, games history, if you go through past incidents, even death, frankly, has not been off limits for lots of fans at lots of times. So the idea of we should be entitled to be as offensive as we want to be, in the sort of the goal of distracting an opponent, that rhetoric goes back a really, you know, long time, I would say, in ultra culture. What is sort of more shocking, I suppose, to me, is the fact that they were willing to put it in a sort of statement that's quite so overt to a player on their own team, something that's not even aimed at an opposing player, but it's specifically, "Listen, you know, chum, you know, we were all behind you a few days ago when you signed, but you need to fall in line with us and understand our way of seeing the world," which really just shows how emboldened this sort of thinking, this attitude has become. It's still worth stressing that we're talking about a statement released by a group that represents maybe 500 people. Even the ultras themselves break down into lots and lots of groups. You know, in every stadium, in every team, there's multiple ultra groups, many of whom are often having their own internal battles. But the sentiment, this idea that it's okay to be making monkey chants and doing things that, you know, are racist actions, but we're not really racist, we're just doing it to distract someone. That idea, I would say, is, you know, unfortunately not new at all.
The club, though, surely have a responsibility here. I mean, what is their relationship with the ultras? You say it's, you know, a select group of 500 or so people. What are the club going to do to respond to it?
Well, let me re-qualify that as well. You know, it's the group that this represents is that number of people. There'll be plenty more outside of that who agree, but there's a larger majority of Inter fans who aren't ultras that disagree. So, you know, I'm not trying to say that there's only 500 people who think this. It's also, you know, what's astounding about this is it's a group of Inter ultras supporting the Cagliari ultras, which goes to show that actually, in a lot of cases, ultras prize this solidarity between the ultra movement, between themselves and other groups of fans, even on rival teams, even who they would fight, you know, when their teams play each other. They prize that above everything, above their clubs, above their players, because this idea of, again, that culture of, you know, we're the important part of football, we are what matters, fandom and how we express it, we're the authentic ones. That's really sort of what underpins all of this. You know, in terms of Inter's response to it, my first instinct is absolutely you want to see the club coming out and condemning it. And I think Inter, if you look at last season when their own fans racially abused Kalidou Koulibaly, the stadium was closed for two games. Inter, I thought, handled that really well. They condemned it immediately. They made no attempt to appeal against the stadium ban, even though it's a negative for them. It cost them money. And they launched this initiative Brothers University United, which is, you know, a slightly cheesy name, but it's to replicate the boo noise that is how you would sort of write out the monkey noise in Italian, the B-U-U. And they were sort of very sort of forward in how they dealt with that. This time they haven't made a statement. And on the one hand, yes, you think they should be condemning this, you should be stepping out and doing it. On the other hand, there is that part of thinking every time you step out and make a public comment on a statement released by a small group of people, are you validating it? Are you only serving to amplify the noise made by those ultras? And I can see both sides of it. I think in this instance, the noise has already been amplified. This story has gone globally. It's, you know, it's in the papers in England. It's in the papers all over the world. And I think at that point, maybe we should have a statement from Inter. But I do at least understand from the club's position the dilemma that you have with something like this, because anyone can make a statement on the internet. Anyone can release what this essentially is, which is a Facebook post that's been picked up and gone everywhere. So how often do you want to give these people more air? It's, you know, it's different in my opinion, for instance, to Cagliari and, you know, their reaction to fans who are literally there in the stadium and, you know, making sure that you ban those fans, making sure that you condemn that, because that's something tangible that you can do, as opposed to just a statement, which, again, can be a double-edged sword in terms of just raising the volume of a certain you know, ignorant group of people.
Yeah, but I mean, we have talked about this. You can go round and round and round in circles as to whether or not you give, you know, add fuel to the flames by talking about it. But equally, you just can't ignore it. And Inter Milan is such a huge club with such a huge following, you know, really, do they have a responsibility to come out and say something?
You know, I'll tell you how I honestly feel about this. There's a part of me that feels like with a situation like this, what matters most is how Inter have spoken to Lukaku, because he was the person who was at the sort of the beginning of this story. He was the person who was racially abused. And I you know, I don't know, honestly, whether or not they've spoken to him and asked him whether he would like them to make a statement, because I sort of feel like that's important, actually. I sort of feel like the person who was targeted might have a feeling himself on whether or not there should be a public statement on this. He obviously made his own public statement after the initial abuse from the Cagliari fans, and that, you know, he was able to get his own voice out on it. I don't know, you know, I can see both sides of it. My personal instinct is yes, you know, I would have liked to see a statement from the club, but I can see there's nuance to that, and I can see that it's not quite as straightforward as sort of being able to say yes, they absolutely should have done this, and there's no reason not to do it.
Nikki, going back a few days to the incident mm-hmm. itself, now that we've had a few days go past, is there any sense that there will be any actual consequences for Cagliari after they've yet again failed to provide an environment in which opponents can do their jobs without being subjected to racial abuse?
Yeah, the most they're going to get, unfortunately, is a fine. And this is, you know, this all goes to the way that the rules are written. The rules were sort of, there were some rules introduced around how you punish clubs for this stuff happening in a stadium under a previous leader of the Italian Football Federation, Giancarlo Aberte. They were then sort of refined by Tavecchio, his successor. Now, Tavecchio has his own, you know, well, he's made, I was going to sugarcoat it there for a second, I don't know why. You know, he made racist remarks on record before he got his position. So this doesn't help this picture I'm about to paint for you. But he introduced some greater details to these legislations, some rules around like, okay, so these things have to be reported by these observers that we have in the stadium. Now, you know, in fairness to Tavecchio, he did say racist things. I don't think that this specific rule can be painted as such. It was an attempt to make things a bit clearer, to say this is how we're going to handle this process of punishing racist abuse in the stadiums. The issue that you've got is that the federal observers, the people who are in the stadium supposed to be hearing these things, have not reported racist abuse in the stadium, which is wild because, of course, now we've all seen videos, we can hear the monkey noises. It's you know, it's something that is completely out there in the public domain, but if you go through the procedure, we haven't got this in our official report, so that the scope of what punishments you can give is limited. So, you know, this happened last year with Moise Kean, exactly the same situation. And last year they didn't get punished at all. This year the worst they're going to face is a fine, and we'll have to wait and see when the federal justice comes down on that.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks very much for joining us, Nicky.
Anytime.
Some other lines around as well this week. Yannick Bolasie apparently rejecting a lucrative move to Russia to protect his family from the threats of racism. Kick It Out's piled pressure on Twitter to combat it. Meanwhile, The Guardian today running that Twitter says it's taken action over more than 700 cases of football-related abuse on the platform in just the past fortnight alone. And Vincent,
I would be, sorry, curious to know what action they've taken.
Well,
they were very vague. We have taken action. That could be, you know, nothing.
And this is
literally.
And this is a key point, isn't it? What is action? What does need to be done? How do we combat it? It's you know, and it's arguably for Twitter to come up with a proper solution for this.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if I post licensed content on Twitter, football content, Premier League content, it's gone in a heartbeat. Mm. If someone posts racial abuse, it's there indefinitely, probably will be there forever. They do little or nothing. So I think this is far too little, too late, but maybe it might be marginally better than nothing. But as I said, they've been very vague about what this action, in inverted commas, is they've taken.
I mean, that was quite telling, wasn't it? When people were posting match video from the incident in Cagliari, that got taken down by Twitter real fast. So I guess that was Twitter taking down some racist abuse almost by accident, because it turned out it was in copyrighted video. So, you know.
Vincent Kompany also saying England's football chiefs need more diversity in the boardroom to combat racism. I mean, it's something that we've talked about on the pod consistently, unfortunately, even more so recently as well. Barry, you had some views.
Well, I just, obviously, I think that what happened to Lukaku in Cagliari, while unsurprising, is also unacceptable. I've found the message posted on Facebook by the Inter Ultras just bizarre, and it's quite depressing insofar as they actually seem to believe that. But I'm also aware that we need to be careful about criticising fans in other countries for their behaviour, because we live in a country where the Prime Minister was yesterday quite correctly pulled up for being a racist in the Houses of Parliament and refused to apologise making fun of Muslim women. And he's also in the past described black people as pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. He's the Prime Minister, so if he's given licence to behave like that, then it's no great surprise that it's going to filter down and other people are going to feel that they're within their rights to behave like that too.
And yeah, you know, as you know, Kompany said, there needs to be more diversity in the hierarchy of English football. You know, it's been you know, the move's been announced this week. There's a lot of black coaches have gone into the England setup, Chris Powell and Michael Johnson. So the steps are being made in the right direction. It's just depressing that it's taken till 2019, and how long it'll take to get to the hierarchy, it'll be sooner rather, you know, sooner rather than later, it seems now. But it, you know, it should have been sped up a lot sooner than this.
I'm sure this is not going to be the last time we speak about this,
it's
unfortunately,
really
which is depressing.
Happening.
Absolutely, absolutely. Moving on, Danny Cowley snubbing Huddersfield, but still in more advanced talks with Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, his stock is really high at the moment. 3 years at Lincoln, joined from Braintree, two promotions, a run to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup, won the EFL Trophy in 2018, currently second in League One and absolutely smashing it. Would he be a good appointment for Sheffield Wednesday?
He's a progressive coach. You know, you mentioned him, but obviously he's there alongside his brother, which is quite a good team to have, you know. I don't think me and my brother would be a fine championship manager team, but, you know. And, you know, the progress they've made as a club has been incredible, from getting out of the National League to getting into League One and very much holding their own. And on top of that, FA Cup runs, you know, they show that they can mix it with various of styles. You know, even against Everton this season, they were, you know, they ran them reasonably close. And, you know, I think he's the sort of manager that deserves a chance higher up. And sometimes if Sheffield Wednesday are particularly great guns, you know, at this stage of their history. So He seems like a good fit.
Peterson on Twitter says, with Icardi joining PSG and Neymar staying along with Cavani and Mbappe, who do you think plays second fiddle to Choupo-Moting this season?
I mean, this is amazing. And I mean, pretty well done to Icardi, I guess, for ending up there. I just think it's great because before the summer, the Paris Saint-Germain owner Nasser Al-Khelaifi made a big play about how the club will not tolerate celebrity behaviour anymore. You know, they got to get more serious and no more messing about. And I thought, all right, fair enough. But then they did seem to make a serious play from recouping the money they spent on Neymar to selling him to where he wants to go. They made some sensible signings, you know, signing Gay from Everton. Like Sarabia is another sort of slightly more humble squad player, though a very, very good footballer. And suddenly the PSG squad is starting to make a little bit of sense, you know, a little bit less Hollywood, a bit less nonsense. Maybe they can turn into a proper football team after all. And then Neymar stays and they sign Icardi. Like, this has gone completely off the rails at the last minute here now. But you see the logic, and I wonder how much it's to do with the fact that you've got both Mbappe and Cavani injured now, which means that you are in sort of Choupo-Moting land with your lineup, which is not the land you want to be in. And there is Icardi's talent is obvious if he can actually become productive and there to be not too many nonsense off the pitch. PSG are in the market for a long-term successor to Cavani up front. So there's a certain logic there. You give him a year to maybe prove himself and prove that he can be a reliable and consistent player and not just a sort of something that creates a lot of drama. And so there's a almost like a trial thing there. But it's odd when you start the summer out wanting to have less celebrity nonsense and you end up signing Icardi, you have to feel something's gone a little bit awry along the way.
Which is exactly the suggestion that 614 Bantam said, Icardi to PSG, worst transfer ever or best idea for a reality TV show ever.
I look forward to the decision on who takes the penalties between Neymar, Cavani and him. It could be an interesting bust-up. No one liking each other on Instagram after that.
Also another weird one. Lucas Piazon signed a one-year extension to his Chelsea contract and moved to Rio Ave on loan for two seasons. He's the longest-serving Chelsea player, despite having played just 15 minutes of league football for them in an 8-0 win over Aston Villa in December 2012.
Good work if you can get it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. A few more questions just to finish things off. Bearing in mind International Week's always quiet and we wonder what we're going to talk about. We've managed so well so far. We could spend 10 minutes, though, discussing William Hughes' question on Twitter, which was, it's the year 2050. How does football look? Game and structure. Heads in hands, absolutely.
It will have merged with the 100 in cricket and it'll be some sort of modern dystopian hellhole.
I reckon I'll be dead by then and won't care.
I'm going to end it.
Yeah, me too as well. There are lifestyle issues here which suggest that, yeah.
Well, Lord Alex Callahan wants to know if you would do a daily hair wash for charity. Daily hair wash until you're dead in 2050?
Who would pay for that?
Yeah, I could. I've nothing fundamentally against washing my hair. I just can't be bothered.
I keep thinking I want to sniff it now. See if it's really stinky.
You might stick to it.
Really?
Wait, is it really stinky?
No.
Why would you want to sniff it? He washes it three times a year.
Which is the thing, to find out if... I mean, because he does shower, so there's water goes through it, but he doesn't wash it. Does that mean it's stinky?
I don't think so.
Oh, listen, I'm going to end this pod on a positive note. And this
by the way, the reason you're here, Faye, because Max was apparently too embarrassed to say on Monday, he's on his annual jolly playing the Stephen Gerrard Golf Charity Classic in La Manga.
Yeah. Oh, hello, Billy Big Time.
This is what you can achieve if you wash your hair regularly.
next year. I've got to end it on this because this is from, I'll be truthful. It is from my cousin, Graham Miles, saying, now that the Hatters have found their stride in the Championship, which other two teams will also gain promotion to the Premier League this season?
Who are the Hatters?
What? And this is Will Unwin's final appearance on Guardian Football Weekly. That is today's Guardian Football Weekly. Thank you for joining us. Max is back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.